Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We got any announcements tonight?
Yes, I recently did an interview with the podcast father. He has a podcast, Indie Podcaster, and it's a pretty good interview. I think you should check it out. Look for it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Awesome. I feel like a bad friend. I haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah, we talk about various subjects, just, you know, starting the show, what we think about how things have evolved and questions about other podcasters or just all kinds of questions, really.
And everybody, if you listen to our show and you like us as people and you want to do us a small favor, go out and rate and review our show. Go out and follow us on social media, whether it be Instagram or TikTok. Go check out our webpage, genypod.com. Please give us some love online.
Yeah, if you go to genypod.com, you could pretty much find wherever else we are on the internet.
So, Aaron, tonight's case is about a couple teenagers. One is a bit of a loner or a shy guy at school, and the other is a 15-year-old female who moved to New York from Columbia. The teenage girl will be brutally raped and murdered, and the teenage boy will end up confessing to this. So with that, what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight, we're talking about the murder of 15-year-old Angela Correa, who, like you said, was originally from Colombia and moved to New York with her stepfather, mother, and younger sister, Diana.
And the young man was named Jeffrey Mark Deskovic. They had a couple classes together. They knew each other not very well, but, you know, just like anyone that's in the same class as you, you know their name, you say hi to them in the hallway. Angela was in a photography class, and her instructor had given them an assignment for them to take pictures together, and they seemed to be at least acquaintances, right?
Right. And one of the classes they shared was when they were freshmen, and the other one was when they were sophomores. And there's sort of a difference in their ages, and it's because Jeffrey was one of those students who was excelling in school. and so was able to skip a grade. So that is kind of a barrier there, possibly. It makes, you know, more of a difference when you're in high school than when you're out.
Now, what happens on November 15th, 1989?
Well, Angela left school at about 2:45 in the afternoon. She went home to change her clothes. She was getting ready to work on her school project, and the teacher for this class had assigned two students for each of the projects so that everyone had a partner. But Angela didn't have a partner because, well, he decided he was not going to work on the project for whatever reason. I don't know if it was for that day or just in general, but she wasn't going to let that stop her. She was going to get this project done. So when she left her house, she had her camera with her, a telephoto lens, and a Walkman-type cassette player. And for anyone that remembers those, yes, she had a New Kids on the Block cassette inside that. So her intention was to go from her house to the woods behind Peekskills Hillcrest Elementary School.
It's not too far from her place. This is her neighborhood. It's a pretty safe neighborhood. No one's going to think much about this.
The next day, Angela's family reported her missing. But get this, and we've heard this before, and yes, we know this isn't how it should be handled, but the Peekskill Police Department considered her a missing person on the 17th of November, not the day she was reported missing.
So they delayed 24 hours after the time. That's just seems to happen a lot. But luckily, I think most police departments do not have any kind of 24-hour delay anymore. But this is 1989.
On the 17th, Angela was located. Police dogs found her. She was found at the pit, which is a wooded area, deceased. Teenagers like to go there and congregate, make out, drink. This is right around Griffin's Pond in Peekskill. Now, the information that the authorities gave said that she was found in the supine position. She was found naked from the waist down, except for socks, and then her shirt and sweatshirt were pushed up. She was partially covered with leaves. Her clothing that had been taken off of her, meaning her underwear and jeans, they were rolled into a ball and placed between her legs. Her shoes were near her feet, and they could tell that she had been beaten, raped, and strangled. One of the first clues that police found was a torn, wet white paper that had been placed under her body, and it looked to be a partial note. It was written by Angela to Freddie, dated November 15th, 1989. So that would have been 2 days prior.
The day she went missing.
Yes. On it was written, "Dear Freddie, those eyes, they kill me." Now, it didn't take long for detectives to figure out that Freddie was Freddie Claxton. He was in the same sophomore class as Angela and lived in an apartment near this Griffin's Pond. And he was dating a girl, Ruth Vega. So police are, well, detectives are picking up, looking for any kind of evidence. They're finding beer and soda bottles. There's broken glass, typical stuff like cigarette butts and gum wrappers. But they found three areas that they believed were tied to this crime scene.
The first one was a path where they believed Angela first encountered whoever killed her. And it was determined that he likely tackled her from behind and forced her onto her stomach. This is where the police found her cassette player, the cassette, and the bag that she was carrying with the camera and accessories. Scene two is 810 feet down an incline and east of scene one on the same dirt path, because there's like a lot of winding trails in this. And the pit is just like a small clearing where they have a couple makeshift places to sit. So at this site, the police found a torn white bra and a piece of a broken cassette player. So during the struggle, this cassette player got shattered and they find more of it. They found more impressions in the dirt and the leaves showing a struggle. They were divots in the ground, impressions in the dirt, and the leaves were all flattened out.
And then there's scene three, which is where her body was actually found. And this was down another incline, down a narrow path, about 133 feet away. Her body was in a depressed part of the ground called, you know, the pit. And it was just a densely wooded area. But because this was sort of a hangout spot, it wasn't exactly hard for them to discover her.
The medical examiner, as well as the police surgeon, were called to the scene, and they pronounced Angela dead at 1:08 p.m. on November 17th, 1989. So there was an autopsy performed on Angela. They found evidence of a rape. There was seminal fluid that was taken with swabs. There were 8 swabs in total that were collected. They also found foreign hairs, pubic hairs, and one of them seemed to be African-American in origin. She was bruised and scratched up pretty good. Her neck had multiple abrasions and scratch marks. These were 1 to 2 inches in length, and there was a 1.5-inch tear on the back right part of her head. Her skull had been fractured. There was a depression of about 1 inch that was identified as the location where a blunt object had struck her head with force. There were other various injuries, including ligature strangulation. There were contusions on her face that were consistent with her being hit in the head with a hand. There were also signs that she had been dragged topless along this path. So, of course, this evidence that they collected from her body and the scene, this was to be sent to the Westchester County Department of Laboratories and Research. The cause of death was asphyxiation by ligature strangulation and fracture of the skull from blunt trauma. He estimated that the murder occurred between 3:30 and 4:30 in the afternoon on November 15th, 1989, the very day she went missing.
And that was an hour after she left her house.
So, of course, the best way to begin this investigation from there would be to go to Peekskill High School. Who knew her?
And who's this Freddie guy?
So they start conducting interviews with many of the students who would have known her, would have known Angela. And there was one person who was supposedly absent from school at the time of death. So what's the coincidence here that Angela is murdered, and at that very point in time, one of the students seems to be missing from school?
And the investigators are going to ask other students about this missing student, and they're not going to give a very good picture of him. They're going to say that he doesn't talk, he's very withdrawn, he doesn't play sports, he doesn't do the things that normal students do. He's more of an outsider.
And the police also learn that this individual has been very distraught and has been crying about Angela's death. And not only that, but he attended her wake. Furthermore, he seems to be conducting his own investigation into Angela's murder. He's collecting newspaper articles, and he's been to the scene.
And this individual is Jeffrey Deskovic. So, of course, they're going to talk to him and try to get his whereabouts on the day she went missing. But these are all teenagers. These are 15, 16-year-old kids. So they're going a little soft, and they're talking to him over time. But eventually, they're going to talk Jeffrey into the police station, and they're going to end up interviewing him for several hours, about 6 or 7 hours. And Jeffrey is going to confess to this murder and this rape, and he's going to break down and cry and tell the investigators all about the horrible things that he did to this poor girl. And he's going to go on to face trial. And at the time, at 16, they could try you as an adult. And this kid, you know, he's confessed. It's all lining up. He's going to trial now. He doesn't have any kind of a defense here because he confessed to the crime. You know, his defense attorney's just saying, hey, I'm not going to put you on the stand. This is over already. I don't even know why we're at trial. So he's found guilty. He's going to be given 15 to life. We're going to put this monster away. Because I don't care if he's 16, right? I mean, if you rape and murder a girl, you should be tried as an adult. You're adult enough to make that decision. So you're adult enough to do the crime, do the time. And we know what happens to rapists when they're behind bars, don't we, Aaron? They get what's coming to them. And Jeffrey, he's going to be assaulted multiple times while behind bars. An attempt on his life will be made where some of the other inmates think that smashing him over the head with weight plates in the weight room might do him in. He ends up surviving that attack. Too bad, right? I mean, our justice system really isn't good enough. We need that extra additional prison justice when they're behind bars, just to make sure that they learn their lesson. And this guy's going to spend 16 years behind bars. But eventually, there's a problem, Aaron. What's the problem with this case?
Well, the first problem with this case is that the police felt like they knew who had done it early on, because someone stood out, and that was Jeffrey Deskovic. They had two detectives who were from the Criminal Assessment and Profiling Unit, and they created a profile of the perpetrator. And they said it would be someone less than 19 years old, shorter than 5'10", someone who knew the victim, who was a loner, unsure around women, and had little involvement in school activities, and probably had a physical handicap or was mentally slow. Well, when they looked at Jeffrey, he seemed to fit most of the things in this profile. Not only that, but anytime the police wanted to speak with Jeffrey, he entertained them, meaning he was all too happy to assist them, telling them what he thought about different aspects of the case. Now, he kept denying his involvement, but like you said, once they actually brought him in and did some real interrogation, that's when he broke down.
Before we get to that interrogation, it's almost 3 months, I think, where one investigator is kind of being a mentor to him, befriending him, talking to him. And Jeffrey didn't have much of a father figure back then. In fact, he claims that he was so involved with school and stuff, he didn't hang out with his mom much either. So he's probably drawn to somebody like this investigator who's going to give him this father figure, this role in his life. And Jeffrey was considering getting into law enforcement himself. So he's really feeling like he's helping out with this case. He truly believes that this investigator is asking him his opinions for his insight, which any 16-year-old would believe that. The rest of us, we all know better. Then, when it comes to the time of the interview or the interrogation, they tell him, none of the kids at the school are talking to us, so we really need your help. But before we can get your help, we need to give you a polygraph, a lie detector test. Are you okay with that? And of course, Jeffrey's all in to help them, but they don't just take him down to the local station. They drive him hours away to another police station to give him this polygraph. And as he's waiting to be hooked up, they offer him some coffee. He's a 16-year-old. He's in this weird environment. They offer him a cup of coffee. He drinks it. Well, there was a coffee dispenser right there. And as he would finish a cup, the cop would go and fill it up again. Jeffrey claims that he might have drank 6 cups of coffee before he took a polygraph test. You know, those tests that track your blood pressure and your pulse and your sweat and all those things that caffeine has a serious effect on. That's weird, right, Aaron? Like, why would they give this kid 6 cups of coffee before a lie detector test? Like, maybe they didn't have any water to give him, right?
Well, if you're not being fed and you're somewhere for 6 to 8 hours without food and all there is coffee, you're probably going to drink it.
Yeah.
Well, at least I would, and I don't even like coffee. But if you're hungry, I mean, you need something.
So Jeffrey sits down in this chair. They hook him up to all the devices and the little things for this test. And they start laying into him. For normally a polygraph test, a long one will take 3 hours. Typically they're around an hour, but if they're going over, it's 3 hours. He was there for over 6.5 hours. And it was a very intense questioning. The detective that had befriended him came in and said, You see all those other guys in this station that are questioning you? They want to put the hurt on you. They want to beat you up, and I'm the only thing standing in between them and you. So you better start telling them what they want to hear.
Yeah, in other words, if you don't give them something, I may not be able to hold them back anymore.
And then the other officer who was in on the polygraph test, he tells Jeffrey, you keep saying you didn't do this, but the polygraph test has already told me that you did. I just need you to confirm it. And he shows Jeffrey how all the spikes on the little graph, you know, and how his heart rate is accelerated and all this stuff and how he's totally nervous and he's completely failed the test. So they know that he murdered this girl. They know everything they need to know. They just need him to say it out loud and sign a little piece of paper saying he did it.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
Well, he does give them a story. He says that he hit Angela over the head with a Gatorade bottle and then chased her down the path and tackled her. She started fighting back, scratching at him. And then he started sobbing and crying and had his hand over her mouth for what he says was a little too long. And he had torn off her bra. But by this point, he's now curled up under the desk, sobbing. But that's all they really need. I mean, they asked him to repeat it and he didn't want to, but they had enough, in their opinion, to make this arrest.
Absolutely. You get a confession, that's all you need. Details and evidence be damned, right, Aaron?
And there's something else that's very important with this whole interrogation, being that Jeffrey was this young guy going to high school. He didn't take this test at the local police station. The police drove him an hour away to Putnam County to do this. And you know, you look back and you think, well, they probably did that so he'd feel really out on his own. Like, the police had all the power.
He couldn't just get up and leave and say, questioning's over, because he had to ask them for a ride home, which if they're already telling him, we're going to beat you up, I doubt they're going to offer him a ride home.
They can tell him whatever they want, right? Because another thing they had told him was, just tell us the truth, tell us what happened, and this will all be over. You can go home. Not true.
The investigators, I mean, they'd been talking to him for a while, and he was very upfront with, this is who I think killed her. This is what I think happened. And he would type up little notes and stuff for the police. He's 16. He doesn't understand that they're targeting him. He doesn't understand that investigators would never ask a 16-year-old what his theory on the murder is. They don't ask you, how do you think this went down, unless you're the one that's in the hot seat.
So on the day of his confession, January 25th, 1990, he was arrested and charged with second-degree murder and first-degree rape. Jeffrey's condition deteriorates quickly because the following day, he's described as suicidal and he was hospitalized. Now, so Jeffrey is arrested, released on bail, and he's hospitalized for quite a while, March till August. And this is at the Rockland Children's Psychiatric Hospital. Now, this is key, Justin. January is not only the month where Jeffrey Deskovic confesses, but it's also the month that the evidence from Angela's body is sent to the FBI laboratory for DNA analysis and compared with a sample of Jeffrey's blood that the detectives got.
Because back then, DNA analysis was still in its infancy, but they could do the blood types. They could do a lot of other things to exclude people. But what did they find on this swab? Several swabs from the victim, actually.
Well, it turns out that an FBI agent notifies one of the detectives that the testing that they had requested in January had been completed. So March 2nd, 1990, the results show that Jeffrey Deskovic was conclusively excluded as the source of the semen that was on those swabs.
Not even close. No match, nothing.
Not even a possibility, no.
Well, we have a confession, Aaron.
What better evidence than the person you think did it telling you, I did it, right?
Yeah.
Now, we mentioned that Jeffrey had said that he used a Gatorade bottle. Back then, they weren't plastic. They were glass.
That's interesting because I remember drinking Gatorade my whole life and I never remember a glass bottle, but maybe that's some sort of a whatever the effect is, Mandela effect, or everyone misremembers stuff.
Mandela effect?
Yeah.
So he was charged with murder in the second degree. This is under three separate legal grounds: intentional murder, depraved mind murder, and felony murder, rape in the first degree, and criminal possession of a weapon, which is that Gatorade bottle, in the fourth degree. So, of course, the prosecution contended that Jeffrey had raped and murdered Angela after he abducted her near the area where she was found.
Well, there's drag marks and there's three different scenes that they're investigating that are hundreds of feet apart. So yeah, he's taken control of her and dragged her around.
So they lay out the case, how it all went down. And they also talk about how Jeffrey had cried, had sobbed. And to them, this is the guilt. So what about this DNA? I mean, it excludes Jeffrey Deskovic. Why doesn't that save him at trial?
Well, the short answer is the prosecutor told the medical examiner to lie. But we can expand upon that, can't we, Aaron?
Well, let's say what they stated at trial, which is essentially that Angela had sexual partners. And so that semen that was swabbed from her body came from a consensual sexual partner of hers, and that's why they found it. So in other words, it doesn't matter what the DNA says, it's not connected.
It's just interesting how they're charging him with sexual assault or rape based on this evidence, but then they turn around and say, well, that's not tied to him. It doesn't match him, so therefore, it's not related to it. It's like, how do you have it both ways? Did anyone think of that? I don't know.
Well, they just figure he didn't secrete anything. That's all. I understand they can explain it away, but that's just theory. If you have science, if you have something you can test, you should test it, right?
Well, and if they think it's from her partner, then at what point was she with her partner? And her partner would have been this Freddy guy, possibly. Or who was her partner? Let's go find them. Let's test them to verify. Goes along with what you're saying.
Right. And how hard did they try to figure out who her partners were? I put that in quotes.
When you have a confession, Aaron, you don't have to.
So, of course, they set this up as This murder occurred because Jeffrey didn't like the fact that she was interested in Freddie Claxton and not him. And they based it all around that note.
Now, Jeffrey also had an alibi for that day, for the time of death. He was with a friend that day, yet his defense attorney doesn't call his alibi witness to the stand, doesn't even really enter it into evidence or allow it to be heard by the jury. And this actually upsets Jeffrey to the point where he says, I want to take the stand. I want to tell my side of the story. But his defense attorney, nah, you don't want to do that. They'll just shred you up there and it won't make any difference. I personally believe that Jeffrey was demanding that he take the stand and his defense attorney said no, which they can't do that. If you want to take the stand, then you can take the stand. But he's a kid and he doesn't really have much say in this matter.
And the detectives who had talked to him, interrogated him really, they were allowed to testify during this trial. But that polygraph examination that Jeffrey was told that he failed, that wasn't actually used at trial. They didn't produce it.
Huh. And at the time, they didn't have to record interrogations. They didn't have to document all the times they questioned a suspect. So the only documentation, the only police reports we have are the ones that make Jeffrey look really bad.
December 7th, 1990 is when the jury reached its verdict. They found Jeffrey Deskovic guilty of felony murder, rape in the first degree, criminal possession of a weapon in the fourth degree, and depraved indifference murder. So before he was sentenced, Jeffrey begged the judge, told him, I'm innocent. The DNA didn't match me. I know this. And well, the judge said, maybe you are innocent, but still sentenced him to 15 years to life.
Also, Aaron, another little tidbit about that judge. When the trial was starting and they were trying to determine whether or not to have a jury trial or a bench trial, it said that the judge had commented to the defense attorney, you better make this a jury trial because I'm not going to be the one that acquits this kid. It's almost as if the judge knew there wasn't any evidence in this case.
Well, we've heard this before, but there's that saying, someone's going to pay for this. They have a guy, jury finds him guilty. Why question it, right? There's justice for Angela Correa and her family.
Now, that verdict came in December. Keep that in mind for later.
So you had mentioned some of the horrible things that happened to Jeffrey in prison, but he didn't just go there and suffer. He started reading because while he's in prison, his appeals are getting shot down over and over again. And he's doing all this reading and he's inspired by a story in the book, Chicken Noodle Soup for the Prisoner's Soul. And the story that got his attention was The Warden Wore Pink. And it was written by Tekla Miller. She was a warden of a maximum security prison at one time in California. So he started trying to contact her because he thought, heck, maybe she knows someone that can help me. And well, he's writing these letters and one of them actually gets forwarded to Claudia Whitman. And she's the person who single-handedly built a nonprofit organization called the National Capital Crime Assistance Network, NCCAN. She's also involved with the Innocence Project at the University of Houston. And she also developed the Capital Defense Handbook to assist prisoners and their families. So this is a connection that's going to be very beneficial to Jeffrey.
Exactly. He will end up sending her a copy of his all of his legal paperwork showing that the DNA didn't match, along with a whole litany of other things that we'll go into in a little bit. But she'd never heard of a case prior to this of somebody being convicted despite a negative DNA test. Like, that's unheard of.
Well, she does something amazing, which is she tracks down the person who did the DNA testing on the case at Quantico, and she contacted him by email, and she wrote to him and said, do you remember this case? And he responded and said, I definitely testified in that case, and there was no match in the DNA. And he said, that guy's not still in prison, is he? And her reply was, yeah, he sure is, and he hasn't been able to get any help. So I want to pause there because that, I can't even imagine what it would feel like for Jeffrey to hear this, that some guy said, he's not still in prison, is he? Why didn't this individual go to somebody and say, what the hell? I mean, like, he thinks that the justice system would have taken care of this because, you know, it doesn't make mistakes. There aren't bad people involved in it, right? It's all on the up and up.
I mean, if you're found guilty, then obviously you're guilty. If you're even sitting in that courtroom, you're guilty. If you confess to a crime, I mean, nobody innocent confesses to a crime. But here we are.
So Claudia tells Jeffrey, write to the Innocence Project. And he said, I already did that. I contacted them in 92 and 93, but they keep rejecting me. And the reason is because the Innocence Project will really only take your case if they can do DNA testing to show that you weren't the perpetrator, that you're innocent, right? Well, because that DNA was already known before the trial and it didn't match him and he was still convicted, I think they took it as, well, it didn't help him then. It's not like they tested it later and figured it out. No, this was known before trial and he was still convicted. So they hadn't ever encountered this before.
And we know, Aaron, that if you put this stuff in trial and it's shot down, they don't really let you reuse it later. So he had his turn in court, didn't work out. I kind of get why the Innocence Project turned him down. I don't agree with it, but I understand why.
But something changed, which allowed them to change their mind. A DNA data bank where you could actually submit the results and see if there was a hit.
Oh, you mean find the person that actually perpetrated the crime, Aaron? Is that what you're getting at?
So the Innocence Project said, okay, we can get behind this. They helped secure additional DNA testing. And it took a little time. I think it took a matter of months, but a name came back, Stephen Cunningham. And get this, when they approached him with this information, he admitted that he murdered her. And he told the story. He said he saw Angela when he was smoking crack in the woods near Griffin's Pond at the pit. He saw her. He started talking to her. He said they talked for about 20 minutes. And he asked her how old she was. She said she was 21. Now, this is according to him. We have no idea if that's true or not. So then he asked her if she would have sex with him. And he said, you know, because he was high, he got aggressive with her. And he got into a rage.
And he's several years older than her. I think he was at least 19 at the time. So that whole profile that they did, completely wrong.
He said that he had stayed quiet about this until the DNA linked him to the crime. He said that he didn't know anyone had been sent to prison for the crime, but people don't believe that.
I'm sure that he was following the news just as much as Jeffrey was.
Now, the good news is Jeffrey met with his Innocence Project lawyer, Nina Morrison, who many of you probably have heard her name before. He had no idea that the results were back, that they had a match, because in his mind, he thought the results were coming in another month. Nina said, no, the district attorney pulled some strings at the lab and the testing was done sooner. I want to say, you know, the original district attorney in the case, who was very much against Jeffrey getting out at all, she had left office at some point. And the successor was all in favor of this additional testing and figuring out what really happened. So I want to give some credit there. But yeah, this is amazing. He's been in prison for 16 years and he's finding out they have the name of the person who did this. And Nina said, you're going home tomorrow. And he didn't believe her. He said, no, I'm not. He started arguing with her just because he had been in prison so long and he was so used to the bad news.
I mean, honestly, Aaron, I wouldn't have believed her either. We know that the gears of justice turn very slow and you usually don't get DNA results and are told you're getting out tomorrow. Typically, it takes months, even if they do have another suspect in custody for your murder. There's always that, I don't know what you call it, that period of time where they have to do all the paperwork and bureaucracy and figure out if the prosecutor doesn't want to somehow say that you were in cahoots with the guy and charge you both.
Yeah, this is where having a district attorney who sympathizes with someone who is innocent is behind letting them go. it makes this all so much easier. And so that was on September 19th, 2006. Okay. September 20th, just like Nina said, he was released from prison. Now, the thing about Jeffrey Deskovic is he didn't just get out and breathe a huge sigh of relief. It's like he got out and hit the ground running. He started meeting with elected officials. He started talking about policy changes to make the system more accurate, more fair, more just. He went and got a scholarship from Mercy College so he could finish his bachelor's degree because he had been working on his degree in prison. Then he was able to get a master's degree from the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and he wrote his master's thesis on wrongful conviction cause and reform. So let me tell you, you and I talked about this, Justin. We've covered a lot of people on our podcast, and some of them are very impressive with what they've done since they've been released. But Jeffrey Deskovic is right there at the top. I mean, he hit the ground running. He's a guy who definitely wants to change the system, and he feels he knows the answers to making this system work better.
I know he hit the ground running, but he struggled so hard when he was released. He was 16 at the time. He'd lost half of his life, couldn't get a job, couldn't do anything. He was really not in a great way because of his whole time behind bars. So it took him a while to get therapy, get help, get all the resources he needed. But he had that drive that you're talking about, and he really is making a splash now.
He talks about that, and I think that's something that people are getting better at, is understanding how important therapy is. But you realize how far you can come once you get the help you need. It just makes things so much better. And so this is a guy that should be very inspirational. And I feel like a lot of people have picked up on that. He's very quick to do interviews. And there's an excellent TED talk that he gave that you can look up on YouTube. So on October 23rd, 2014, a federal jury awarded Jeffrey Deskovic $40 million after finding that ex-Putnam Sheriff's investigator Daniel Stevens fabricated evidence and coerced Jeffrey's false confession. And this is one of the things he talks about, is if they would just record every interrogation, then it would be easier to show that there was a false confession. And one of the things he says is, if you're talking to someone and they're giving you answers, but they don't match the evidence, and then the police, the detectives, are now giving you the information you need so that you sound like you understand what happened, there's your problem. That's just one thing. He also talks about how important it is that prosecutors are held accountable, because they aren't. And if you can't hold them accountable, why do they have to do the right thing? What's in it for them?
We always talk about how the system protects itself. But in this case, you know, we never define what that means. We never give examples. But this case is a perfect case study on that. You have investigators who misprofiled the suspect, had blinders on when they went after Jeffrey, got a false confession out of him, knew there was no physical evidence tying him to this crime scene, because they found fingerprints, they found hair fibers, they found semen. None of it matched him. Then we get into a courtroom, and you have a prosecutor who's like, oh, well, how do I figure out how to convict this guy when none of the evidence matches him? Oh, I have to get the medical examiner in on it now. Oh, the judge, he knows that this kid's probably innocent, but the judge, you know, this is big news in this town. And everyone wants this rapist, murdering monster put away. And the judge is like, I'm not going to be the one that acquits him. You get a jury to do it. That way I don't have to deal. I don't need that backlash on me, because I don't want to be taken off the bench. And then you have the parole boards, the appeals courts, shooting it all down, saying, no, we crossed our T's, we dotted our I's. This was a good conviction. The system protects itself. Now, this made big news, Aaron. And when it did, one of those jurors, one of those initial jurors from his first trial, came forward to his attorneys, his new attorneys, said, hey, is that guy getting out of prison? They're like, yeah. And that juror said, well, that's good, because I never thought he was guilty. And of course, his attorneys were like, then why did you vote guilty? And that jury said, well, it was like 10 against 1 I was the last holdout. And they told me that if I didn't get to a verdict soon, we would all be sequestered for the Christmas holiday. So all the pressure was on him because nobody wanted to miss Christmas with their family. It's easier to vote guilty and put a guy away for life for a crime he didn't commit. Now, we could all be mad at that one juror, but we had all the other jurors who were blind to evidence, didn't want to hear it, and just wanted to go home and be with their families. And we had a judge that wasn't brave enough to do the right thing, because a judge can acquit you even if you're found guilty by a jury. So as much as I'm appalled by this juror's decision to vote guilty, it's not just his fault.
Well, I think it's easy to point the finger, and I think that juror should feel some guilt, quite honestly, but you know, we're not in their shoes. And there's something to be said for all that pressure that was put on them. What does that say about our system that we're more worried about getting home for Christmas than making sure that that choice we make, you know, when we decide someone's fate, that it's the right one? I don't think it's just that juror. I think that might be society as a whole. How many people would have done the right thing there? This isn't 12 Angry Men. I always try to find the silver lining, Justin. In this case, it's that despite all the horrible stuff that happened, Jeffrey Deskovic is making a difference. And there was something he said in his TED talk that really hit home with me, which is when the system failed him, it also failed Angela Correa and her family. Because when they went after Jeffrey and took him to trial and convicted him, the person who raped and murdered Angela went on to kill a school teacher who was a mother of two kids. So when people say, well, the system isn't perfect, the problem here is they had it right in front of their face, the evidence they needed to show that Jeffrey didn't do this, or at the very least, it was unlikely to be him. And they never bothered to hunt down who the person was that left that evidence on Angela.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/genY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/genY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/genY.
I don't want to hear people say that they're tough on crime, and then that just means that you want more police officers on the street and you want longer jail sentences for people. Because to truly be tough on crime, you need to go after the actual criminals and you need to support the evidence. You need to support not only the boots on the ground or the officer patrolling, but you need to support the follow-up. You need to support evidence collection. You need to support evidence testing and complete transparency in the investigation. And we need to bring it all to light in the courtroom. Just a little pet peeve of mine when I hear people say they're tough on crime, because this guy, this murdering rapist, went on to do more harm to society because they thought they were being tough on crime.
And someone else died because of that. And that's why when Jeffrey talks about holding prosecutors accountable, this is why we need that to happen. You know, why is it that everything needs to be regulated except prosecutors? When they want to regulate everything under the sun, don't they? But not a prosecutor. Why is that? It just doesn't make sense. I mean, if you're on the up and up, you shouldn't have to worry about it, right? Isn't that what they say? If you've done nothing wrong, you don't have to worry about it.
Because if you have nothing to hide, then what's your problem? But yet, what does our system have to hide? What does a prosecutor have to hide? Why can't we have some more transparency there? And the whole appeals process in Jeffrey's case, every single time it was shot down, regardless of solid physical evidence proving that he wasn't the perpetrator, and if there was ever a case for ineffective counsel, not bringing up his alibi, not letting him testify, not cross-examining any of the witnesses that the prosecutor put on the stand. Give me a break. The appeals process is a joke. It's just a rubber stamp of what the system decided in your first trial.
Rubber stamp is right. Again, Jeffrey noted in his TED talk that one of the judges who denied his appeals was Sonia Sotomayor. She is a Supreme Court justice these days. So let that sink in. Do you really think she examined his case before she made her determination? Because I don't feel like she did. How can we look at this case and say he has been fully exonerated? This isn't just they let him go because things got a little weird. No, he was fully exonerated. How did she miss that? But again, the silver lining here, Justin, is that someone like Jeffrey, despite all he went through, can talk about how the system failed the victim, how it failed him. And not only is he fighting to make a difference, but in 2019, he was able to pass his bar exam and he's now an attorney. He said he wanted to be involved, not just watching. He wanted to be involved at that level.
Because this is straight out of SLC Punk. You can't make changes to the system from the outside. You have to be part of it. And you have to be the change that you wish to see in the world. That's what he's doing. And he's helping other wrongly convicted prisoners get free. And he's not just going in there and talking to him, oh, you didn't do it. Okay, no. You have to prove your case to Jeffrey first before he takes it. And he is only going after actual innocent prisoners. He doesn't go after technicalities. He's only going after prisoners like him.
He's been a part of a number of cases now where people have been released from prison. So definitely would suggest checking out his website. It's Deskovicfoundation.org. We'll include a link in the show notes. Also, I'd like to give Jeffrey Deskovic a shout out, as well as Marty Tankliff. These are two of the guys that really stand out that we've had interaction with. And I think these are the types of people that are going to make a difference down the road. I really hope that their dreams are realized, because one day we might be able to say, our system's not perfect, but damn, it's trying. Never miss an episode of Generation Y. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you're listening right now. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. Our TikTok is at Gen Y Pod. Our Instagram is at Generation Y Podcast. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.